morning. My name is Mary, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm here only by the grace of God and the people who cared about me when I couldn't care about myself. I've been on an emotional roller coaster, and I'd like to thank the committee for asking me to participate. But I'll tell you the truth, I wouldn't give this spot to a leopard. I noticed during the opening meeting that there were quite a few people here. We're here for the first time, new people. And lest I get caught up in my story and forget to tell you my message to you, it's this. That probably by now you have found that trying to quit drinking is like making love to a gorilla. You may think you're through, but you're not through till the gorilla's through. An instant alcoholic. I don't understand social drinking. In fact, I get nervous when I'm around those people. I went to my brother's house one Christmas after I was sober a couple of years, and I went with an AA friend of mine, and I guess it's my whole attitude, because the first woman I saw there was a little old lady, and she had one of these tall anemic drinks with ice and mix, and she was sipping that drink. And I wanted to belt her in the mouth. And then, you know, there were about eight people drinking there, and I went into the kitchen, and there was a supply. This embarrasses me to tell this. There was a pint on the kitchen table with the lid on it. Then, you know, the worst thing possible happened. My brother came in where my sister-in-law was stirring something on the stove and asked her if she'd like to have a drink. And you know what she said? She said, "No, thanks. I'm beginning to feel mine." Make me nervous. I saw a man at that very same party put his drink down on the coffee table and walk into the next room and leave that drink there unattended. And my hands sweat when I even talk about that one. I guess I can wrap up my drinking career by telling you, by quoting what the cat said when he got through making love to the skunk. He said, "I didn't get all I wanted, but I got all I could stand." I see a lot of you identify with that. I left home when... the day after I graduated from high school. And my escape hatch in those days was, I was a dancer, and I was a featured dancer, and when I was out on that stage with a spotlight on me, I was in a world all of my own. And that's where I was the most comfortable the rest of my life, being all out there, all by myself, out there by myself, with no responsibilities. And I joined a road show, and it was while I was on this road show that I was introduced to slow gin. Now, I know, you see the tittering around here. That dates me, I know that. And, you know, because of that, I've been thinking about getting a facelift. Yeah, it's very fashionable. But why get a facelift when everything else is sagging 2 inches below where it used to? I tell you, it's a sad day when you find yourself trying on one of those cross-your-knees bras. Of acceptance, you can see that. But anyway, I drank that slow gin, and I liked immediately how it changed the whole world, you know. I drank alcoholically right then, because I drank as much as I could, threw up and passed out, figured that was part of the deal. Now, I can't say that that I got drunk every day, but it seems to me that every time I started to drink, I got drunk. I could never predict my conduct. I never could do that. And so after I got through this tour, I wound up in the nightclubs of San Francisco where I was a featured dancer. That's where I met Mike Ross. I broke your anonymity, Mike. That's where I first met Mike. And, gosh, you know, to all outside appearances, I should have been very happy. And I had the spotlight on me. I had Herb Cain writing me up in his column. He called me the Belle of Bush Street. And, you know, I had fancy clothes and a fancy pad to live in. And I had a lot of attention from the men. You know, that's utopia, right? No, it wasn't. The thing was that there was something unfulfilled and missing in my life. And I didn't know what it was. At that time, I thought it was the fact that Hollywood had not discovered me yet. And that would be my whole fulfillment of life. If when Hollywood discovered me, then everything would be wonderful. And came the day when an agent invited me down to take a screen test at one of the major studios. And I came down with the attitude that Betty Davis had better start saving her money because I was on my way. Now, that's that ego that covered up the terrible, terrible fear. In fact, I was born scared, and I didn't know it until my sponsor told me I was. Because, she's always saying, when are you going to stop trying to be big, brave, and strong? And I just kept going that way. I just thought that was the way I had to be. Anyway, I went down there, and I took a screen test, and it was rotten. How can you act when you're already acting? I didn't know that, see. But they did sign me to a stock contract, which means you're part of the herd. I mean, no big deal. You're just there. And I did, you know, some things. But the most important thing that I have to tell you is, strangely enough, first thing I did is get caught up with the drinking crowd. Is that surprising? I got caught up with the drinking crowd. And if you newcomers are wondering what are you going to tell your friends that drink, just remember, we don't hang around people that don't drink. And it's going to be okay. But I got caught up with the drinking crowd, and I reverted to my role of playgirl. And I just really wasn't doing very much in that motion picture industry. And I couldn't. I just hoped that some enterprising young producer would see me and, you know, just make a big star out of me. And it wasn't happening. In the meantime, I was making all of the nightclubs and supper clubs up and down Sunset Boulevard and all those places. And, you know, laughing from the outside and nothing from the inside. And toward the end of the second year, I just happened to feel that my career in pictures was not going anywhere. And I started to worry a little bit. And about that time, a man from the USO office in Beverly Hills came and offered me an opportunity to go overseas and entertain the soldiers because the World War was on it. World War II was on at the time. And I immediately jumped at that chance because of all the men over there. You girls understand that. And all the attention I was going to get that I wasn't getting on the lot there. And so I went overseas. And this trip took us to China, Burma, and India. And it seems to me, that's a long time ago, years and years ago. It seems to me that if I knew anything about alcoholism at that time, which I didn't, that I would have recognized one of the primary clues of alcoholism, and that is defending my right to drink. Because we were in the Himalaya Mountains, and I was drinking. Are there any guys from that World War in the audience today? I want to tell you that if you resent USO girls from fraternizing only with the officers, then I was very democratic with my drinking. And maybe you can lose that resentment right now. I drank with Yardbirds, generals. It didn't make any difference to me. I just said, where, let's go. Anyway, we were in the Himalaya Mountains at this time, and I had come to after a night of drinking grapefruit juice, and who cared? The night before. And I couldn't move. I was absolutely paralyzed. My roommate noticed that there was something terribly wrong with me, and she went and got the medics, and they came trooping in, and they gave me shots, and they gave me oxygen, and they walked me around, and they worked on me for about 2 hours just to get me on my feet and functioning again. And you know, I blamed the altitude. I didn't even drink in Denver after that. I just knew I couldn't drink in altitude. Now, that's defending your right to drink. Anyway, when I came back, I felt very put upon by the military. We were under military orders, and I felt very put upon because they hadn't told us that they expected us to party in between shows and do all that stuff. Well, actually, they hadn't. That demand came from me because I needed approval. I needed approval desperately, and I couldn't say no to anything. I really could not say no to anything. One of the big freedoms I have found in this program is the fact that I can live in a manner that's acceptable to me, regardless of public opinion. And that's a long way for me to come, because as long as I'm playing the part, trying to get your approval, I'm throwing away my own. And that's the one I need the most, and that's the one you need the most. And so when I was offered the opportunity to go to Europe, I jumped at that chance, and I bet you don't know that my story is in the big book. It's called Chapter 3. I'm a product of countless vain attempts. But Chapter 3 says this time it's going to be different. Well, that's what I said to myself. I'm not going to get involved in all that partying and drinking and carrying on. Maybe I'll have a drink once in a while, or maybe I'll go to a party once in a while, but I'm not going to do all that I just got tired of over in China, Burma, and India. So this time it was different. It was worse, because I didn't know how not to get caught up in it. And this is what I got into a lot of trouble over there. This probably comes as no surprise to you. I may be the only USO girl that was up for court martial. I was mad. I'll tell you something. I was always madly in love. Either that or recovering from love, and I don't know which I enjoyed the most. When you're recovering from love, you can get that sad music on, and get the jug out, and those crocodile tears come out. Oh, God, I used to love that bittersweet agony. Jesus. My favorite song was The Man That Got Away. God, I used to love that. I still do, But anyway, I fell in love with this guy, and here I was some towns beyond where I first met him, and again in another drinking party, and I suddenly decided that I needed to hear the voice of my beloved, so I went over and got on a field telephone, which meant you went through relays, and it took some time to make connections, and I was sitting there waiting to hear this voice. And this captain, who was also drinking, was leaning over me, asking me to go drink or play or whatever. And I told him that I was waiting to talk to the great love of my life. And that captain did something terrible. He took his thumb and disconnected the phone. And I said to the captain, "If you do that once more, I'm going to hit you." He didn't believe me. Because I just about got through again, and he did it again. And since I had the phone right here in my hand, I whacked him on the ear, inadvertently, I like to say, and he was so stunned that he didn't realize what happened for a minute, and I guess I had some bewildered look on my face, because I saw the blood gushing out of his ear and down his white trench coat, and when he saw that, he screamed like a banshee and ran across the street to where the MPs were hustled and signed all these papers, and they came trooping over, and he pointed me out. Yeah, that's humiliating. And he pointed me out, and they ordered me to appear the next morning at 10 o'clock for a hearing. Now, my God, I could not stand the idea of being sent home in disgrace, like one of the other gals was. I couldn't stand that, so what do? You spend the rest of the night trying to figure out how you're going to get out of this one. Did you ever do that? So I figured that since there were... since there were 14 other girls on the show, that if I took two other brunettes with me to this hearing, there was an outside chance that this guy would not be able to identify me. And we got there, and that poor captain was sitting there, and he had a hangover that was coming over in waves. You've seen those, and maybe experienced them. He had poached eyes and red face, and God, it was just, I just almost felt sorry for him there for a minute. And he was not able to identify me. Now, I always tell that story because I have this big dream, and I bet you can guess what it is. In looking back, I am almost certain that he was one of us. by, you know, remembering his behavior. And, of course, my big dream is that he found his way to our fellowship. And that one day, or one night, I will be telling the story from the podium, and he will be in the audience. He might even be today, I don't know. And after the meeting, he will come up to me with his hand extended, and he will say, "Mary, I'm the captain that you hit on the ear in Germany, and I'm going to let him make his amends to me." We weren't always wrong, you know. Even the clock that stopped is right twice a day. Incidentally, I found out what makes the grass greener on the other side of the fence. They take better care of their lawn. Don't you hate those simple answers, you know? Anyway, I had not realized it, but my alcoholism had already started to erode my spirit. Yeah, that's the only way I can put it, because it wasn't working anymore. The alcohol wasn't doing what it once did, and that had happened long before I realized what was happening. And I was in a constant state of melancholy, I guess, or what they call depression. I was on a bummer is what I was most of the time. And I couldn't, I just blamed man's inhumanity to man, because I was over there at the time they were, you know, getting all the evidence of the Nuremberg trials, and I saw all that, and it was just devastating to me. But it didn't affect the other members of the show like it did me. My thing was mostly the alcoholism, I think, where it seemed like the lights were going out all over the world, and it just, everything was turning gray. And I don't know, I was trying so hard to lift my spirit, and I couldn't do it. It just was impossible. And I knew that the only place for me was to go back to the nightclubs of San Francisco, where I had so much fun. God, how much fun can you endure? And I got back there, and God, everything seemed to have changed. Even my best drinking buddies, they all seemed different to me. And again, it was that terrible desolation that we get to know, that, you know, no direction. Where am I going? What am I going to do? And I finally thought, you know, I've been all over the world. I've done everything. The only thing left for me to do is to get married. So I carefully selected a victim. And it happened to be a bartender I couldn't stand. Mike was supposed to be the best man, and he got lost someplace. You know, the Al-Anons will tell you that every pot goes out and finds a lid that fits it. Well, this guy didn't drink, and, you know, that should have been my first clue right there. He didn't drink. But he did turn out to be a compulsive gambler. And I'll give you a clue as to what kind of a marriage. Well, it wasn't really a marriage. It was more like a suicide pact. He gambled my drinking money, and I drank his gambling money. And anybody will tell you that's a tense way to live. So at this point in my life, I could not stand the idea of another failure, because I felt like such a failure in everything I tried. In fact, everything I did, I always felt like an imposter. You know, people, they talk on this program about not fitting in. I always felt like an imposter, no matter what I did, no matter how much applause I got, no matter what, how wonderful they told me I was, I still felt like an imposter, and God help me if they ever found out about me. You know, I don't know about anybody else identifies with that, but that's the way I always felt. Anyway, I couldn't stand another failure, and so I decided the best thing for us to do is to move down to San Fernando Valley, down to down to suburbia, you know, where I get him away from all the gamblers. And I'm sure that he had the same idea about getting me away from all my drinking buddies. And so we moved down to Encino, and he found some bookies right up on the corner, and I found a drinking buddy right across the street, and the race was on again. Now, I just knew that, you know, this is not going to work out, but I thought, now, if I have a baby, that'll get everything put together nicely. So I got pregnant, and with that pregnancy, my whole image of what I wanted to be changed. I was going to be the best housewife, the best mother, the best everything, perfect I was going to be. And I knew that above everything else, this woman that I was going to be did not drink. So I went on the wagon. You notice how my voice trembles when I say that? And, you know, I got crazier than I ever did drinking because I became a compulsive housekeeper. There are a few others in the audience. There always are. There's one right over there, I'll bet. I used to clean the corners with pins. And I had Q-tips in one pocket over here that I got under the little ledges with. And I had a toothbrush in this pocket to clean the lettering on the appliances with. See, she's nodding. I know there's always one. And you know, if the old man got out of bed in the middle of the night to go to the John, his bed was made before he got back. That's, you know, that's madness. That's that madness we talk about here. Wasn't hard for me to look at that second step, I'll tell you that. I don't know. That isn't too much of an exaggeration because I was talking one time and telling this story, and an Al-Anon lady came up to me after the meeting, and she was laughing. She had identified with everything, and she said, "But I did something you didn't do." And I said, "What's that?" And she said, "I used to blow the dust out of the keyholes." See, it's things like that that make me know I'm in the right place. I just feel right at home here because these are the things that I used to hide from myself. I couldn't even admit them to myself. Now my life's an open book and I can tell everybody about it. But that's that insanity we're talking about, I suppose. And this went on for quite some time. As a matter of fact, when that kid was born, it's a wonder I didn't boil him because by that time I was washing the walls with Hexol, you know, and keeping everybody at arm's length, and I just wouldn't let his grandmother see her first grandson, you know, very close. I mean, that's crazy. That's crazy. And this went on for a while until I found out I was pregnant with a second child. And, you know, I hadn't planned that one. You know how that goes. I always drank with two attitudes. One was, what's the use? And the other is, I'll show him. And here it was both. Because I knew this guy was trying to keep me pregnant and barefoot and out in the country. And I couldn't stand it. And so, with that kind of resentment and that kind of disappointment and disillusionment, it sparked the fires of my alcoholism again. And I decided to have a few drinks with a lady across the street. And so, I drank with her and got away with it for a while. And you know, I'd like to tell you new people that when you drink and get away with it, it's like a guy jumping out of the Empire State Building. And as he passes the 30th floor, he says, "So far, so good." Because that's what happened to me. I was only going to drink a little bit, you understand. I was only going to drink a little bit. But I found again and again, out of control, drinking. And this is about the time that I found my favorite place, the neighborhood bar. I was a bar drinker. I loved the bars. Oh, my God. You know, I could walk into a bar with a dollar and stay for 3 days. And you guys that are laughing were picking up my tab. Oh, God, I loved it in there. You know, they were telling me how desirable and intelligent and sexy and everything I was. They weren't telling me that at home, but they were telling me that in the bar. And that unreal atmosphere and then the tinkling piano. Oh, God, I loved it. I loved it. But my husband took a dim view of my action, and after the baby was born, he left me, and then he came back. It was always with the promise that he wouldn't gamble so much if I wouldn't drink so much. And, you know, that's insane. Because we couldn't keep our own promises to ourselves, never mind anybody else. And back and forth and back and forth, and as a result of one of those joyous reunions, I got pregnant the third time. Now I was outraged womanhood. God, I couldn't stand it. I absolutely couldn't stand it. This was not, you know, it was all his fault, and this is not what I wanted out of life, and I knew that I was terribly miscast in this role of mother. And I was a failure there, and the only thing for me to do is, the only place I felt comfortable was in the bar, or drinking with the people across the street, or, you know, with those people. And so I don't say this with any pride, but during my last pregnancy, I was drunk most of the time. I say that with no pride at all, but I don't have to carry that terrible remorse and guilt that that drove me down with my eyes downcast all the time either. And when my daughter was born, my husband left me for what proved to be the last time because I was not willing to do anything. I could not do anything. It wasn't that I didn't care, it was that I couldn't care. I just really could not care. Life had defeated me and I knew that this was my lot and I was a failure and so what's the use? What's the use? And so, when he left, those things that happened to alcoholic women started happening to me in rapid succession. I remember coming to in an alley one cold gray dawn, sick and shaking and scared, and wondering what had become of the Great Bell of Bush Street. And I remember being ordered out of that bar where, which was my second home, by the bartender at 10 o'clock in the morning, saying, "Out, Mary." And I had no recollection of having been there the night before because I had long since been into blackout drinking and passing out and those kinds of things. And I hope I never forget the Sunday morning that I was lurching down Ventura Boulevard, drunk and dirty, and falling down, and coming upon this church where Mass was letting out, and this family came coming down the steps with their two sons. And I hope I never forget the look in those kids' eyes to see this drunken, dirty, alcoholic woman. See, my knees would never hold me up. I didn't want to be there, you know that. I didn't want to be that. But I had no choice. I hope I never forget that. And so I tell you that many other things happened in rapid succession that drove me to drink behind closed doors and drawn shades in my madness, knowing that my madness was leading me to homicide, knowing that I would kill this man that caused all this. And at that time, these thoughts were valid. They were valid. And I knew he was the reason. He was the cause of all this. And I was drinking around the clock. And I don't know why it was, but I got this almost audible thought that said, "Mary, you desperately need help." And I found myself talking on the phone to the North Hollywood Clubhouse. And Al Bam remembers a young fellow by the name of Paul who answered the phone at that time. And he sensed my whatever he sensed. And he said he'd be right out. He broke one of the unwritten rules of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because men are not supposed to call on women. But I'll tell you, God in his infinite wisdom knew exactly the person to send to me because I was in no condition to welcome a couple of Salvation Sioux. And he came out. And I guess that place was pretty poor in those days, Alabama, because the only literature he brought out was the front cover of the Grapevine, Serenity Prayer. And I was, if he came out there with any romantic inclinations, I can tell you that when I opened that front door, all the romance would have flown out of his body because he was met by, especially if he was downwind, he was met by 180 pounds of gray screaming insanity. And I was drinking vodka out of my cheese glass, and he brought this literature to me, and he had this big smile, and he started talking, and I don't remember anything he said. I do remember he had this big smile, and I do remember that he said, "You're an alcoholic." Now that's another rule he broke, and I thought, oh, I'll pretend that I am. I really didn't think I was. I'll pretend, I'll go along with it, because nobody else was talking to me. No, my neighbors were not talking to me. Long distance was hanging up on me, and I was lonely. So anyway, he started talking about going to a meeting that night, and I agreed to go to a meeting because I knew that there were other people that probably would talk to me too. And so before we left, I put my raincoat on. It wasn't even raining. I don't know why I did that. But I put the raincoat on, and I poured myself another drink. And I said, "Are you sure that it's okay for me to drink?" And he said, "Yeah." Well, that got my attention, you know. And I said, "You mean I can pour this drink and go to a meeting if I drink this drink?" He said, "Certainly." And I said, "To hell with it." I've been allowed to stay sober since that time. And that was March 29th, 1961. And you know, he took me out to a little place out in Chatsworth. Do you people know how far it is from Encino to Chatsworth, for God's sake? We kept driving and driving and driving, and it was getting more desolate and darker and darker, and we'd gone into the hills out there, and I thought, this guy's going to kill me out there. And I was hoping he was, you know, that I had been a failure at suicide also. I was just hoping the guy would kill me. But we got out there, and it was a little room behind a church there. God, there must have been 20 people in that place, and he suggested I look in the window, and I saw these people, and God, it looked like a PTA meeting to me. And I thought, my heart started to sink, and I started to back away, and he sensed this. So he urged me to come to the front door and look in, and I did that, and he took his hand and shoved me in. And he broke another rule. That's promotion. That's not attraction. And there he introduced me to the woman who was to become my first sponsor. And she represented everything I hated in women. She was soft-spoken, spiritual, well-groomed, cunning, baffling, and powerful. And she spoon-fed my soul. I do not remember what went on in that meeting that night, but I tell you, I will never forget what I felt at that meeting. The same thing I feel today in this room, the power, the power. It was not hard for me to find a power greater than myself because my sobriety was ignited that night with the power that I felt in that room, and there were about 20 people in there. And so my sponsor took me home, and she said that she would pick me up at 8 o'clock. In those days, they didn't say, "Would you like to go to a meeting tomorrow night?" They said, "I'm going to pick you up, and you be ready at 8 o'clock. And she was soft, you know, like that. She scared the hell out of me. So as she drove away, she said, "By the way, we're going to go to a woman's stag." I was threw up. I was too afraid to tell her I hated women. So she said, and as she was leaving, over her shoulder, she said, "Would you please take a bath before I pick you up?" And I thought, what the hell do they want from me, these people? Don't they know who I am? And you know, the next day, I was sick. I had to get well to die. That's how sick I was. I was shaking, and I was sweating, and I was so sick, and I still had a half a bottle of vodka there, and I wanted that with every pore in my body. But, you know, I remembered one thing that they told me that night. They told me that any damn fool can stay sober for 24 hours, and I didn't want to be a damn fool. So I just hung on there, and that's what they told me. And she picked me up, and we went to Woman's Stag down in Van Nuys. And I got to that, and I knew damn well I didn't belong there. The woman that was leading that meeting was so elegant. Oh, my God. She had long, blonde hair, every hair in place, page boy, and a little black expensive dress with pearls. And she was sitting there with such dignity, and I thought, Jesus, a toast burner, you know. But, you know, I think that when the student is ready, the teacher will appear, because one of the gals that got up started talking in my native tongue, profanity. And I suddenly zeroed in on her. I had a sudden surge of hope again. And so it was that I started going to 10 meetings a week, and I went, I covered the whole valley. I just loved it. I just didn't understand what you people were saying. I just wanted to be with you. This unconditional love and this, I mean, they just accepted me. No one had done that for so many years, and I was so thirsty, so hungry for it. And so I started going to all these meetings, and my husband found out that I was going to AA, and he became so incensed that he started calling me during the day, threatening to take my children, threatening to kill me in his own insanity. He had me hanging by my fingernails. Just, you know, the homicide was still up here in my throat. I wanted to kill this guy, drunk or sober. And I called my sponsor one day and I said, I'm going to kill that guy if he doesn't lay off of me, calls me, he's threatening and he's doing all these things. What am I going to do? And she said, hang up. It never occurred to me. God, I come from where you get even. And so, the next time he called, I just take up the phone and I said, I'm sorry, but you're upsetting my serenity. And I hung up real fast. And finally, he stopped calling me. And finally, I started to grasp the program. And I started to grasp, what you were saying to me. And, of course, that my case was always different. You know, I was the queen of the Yabbats. And it wasn't too long. It was a couple of months, I guess, that I got word from him that he wanted to talk to me on a friendly basis, and I thought, okay. By that time, I had calmed down considerably myself, and we were able to sit down and talk about the future of the children and et cetera, et cetera. This is not to say that we were going to go back together and walk hand in hand into the sunset. We both realized we had made a mistake in our marriage, and we went along like that, and then one of the old hard-nosed guys from my home group out in Chatsworth suggested that I make my amends to him. And, of course, I didn't want to do that. But I tell you, it took me a long time to even become willing. But in the meantime, he had had a bad day at the races again and called me and threatened again and just blew the whole thing. And thank God that was the night of the woman's stag, and I went screaming in my madness and saying the same things that I did when I first came in. And you know what that elegant lady said to me? She said, pray for the son of a bitch. Yeah, that's the last thing I wanted to do. Of course, everything's been the last thing I wanted to do, starting with step one. So that night, at the conclusion of the meeting, I started to pray, and I prayed for him. I didn't mean a damn word of it. I'll tell you that. I didn't mean a damn word of it. But the thing was that eventually, what this praying did not change him one iota. It lifted this terrible hatred from me. That's what the prayer did. And that's the function, I think, of the prayer. And so it was later on that I was, it was suggested to me that I make amends to him, which I did. And I think that's probably one of the greatest love gifts that was forced upon me by those people who cared about me when I couldn't care about myself, because I was able to make my amends to him just 2 weeks before he died of a heart attack. And I don't know what would have happened to me had he died when I hated him so much. But instead of that, I was freely given this gift of forgiveness by those people who cared about me. And so now I was left with three small children and very heavily in debt, and a little restaurant that was also heavily in debt to the IRS. And I was told by those hard-nosed old people out there, this is a spiritual program, I can't say that, that I had the responsibility of paying back the IRS, and that it was my responsibility to run that restaurant until the debts were paid, and which I did. But in the meantime, you know what happened? All the AA people started coming in, drinking up all my coffee. And pretty soon we had a meeting there, and pretty soon we had a couple of meetings there. And at the end of the year, we had about three meetings there, and the landlord agreed to let us turn that place into a clubhouse. And still in existence, it's the Nest out there in the valley. It's a very sick place, I know that, but a lot of people, a lot of sick people got well there. You know, that's what it's for. It's like a hospital, you know. Anyway, it was after that that I got into a brief AA marriage. A lot of you know him. I think we both entered the marriage thinking, as many AAs do, that since we're both in AA, you're way ahead of me. Since we're both in AA, and of course he and I had showbiz background, and I mean, it was just made in heaven, that's all it was. But it wasn't. But the difference between this and the other was the fact that we were able, after a short time, to walk away from each other without any bitterness or rancor. Or I mean, in the beginning there was a little, you know, everybody gets hurt a little bit, but later on, you know, we were still friends. We were still friends. That's, you know, that's what one of the AA teachings is. And so I got a job in a hospital kitchen. I was supposed to be learning to be a diet aide, but I wound up washing pots and pans and cleaning employees' toilets because the dishwasher would be drunk most of the time. That's the most menial job I've ever had in my life. But they tell me that's an AA success story, you know. I stayed at that job, and I eventually worked my way up to being assistant cook out in Encino, and I hated that job. You know, it was a hotbed of neurotics down there. And, you know, there's no way you can talk to a neurotic. You can to alcoholics, but not neurotics. And I just hated it. And, I used to go to work with clenched fists and gritted teeth. And, oh, I hated it. I hated it. In the meantime, my first sponsor had moved up north after I became a year sober. And I had to get a new sponsor. And a lot of you know that it's that dictatorial Clancy. Thank God for him, because the teachings or the lessons that I learned were to come in. They were so valuable to me in this last year that I can't even describe it. And he told me at that time, when I wanted to quit that job, that when God wanted me to move, he'd move me. And so I stayed at that job for several years, and I was putting one foot in front of another. I had no money. I was gratefully accepting the clothes from the women of Alcoholics Anonymous, and my kids were getting clothes from the Alcoholics Anonymous people. And, you know, I got a lot of compliments on this suit this morning. You like it? You should. You bought it. Anyway, everything I own you bought, you know. Because I came in with nothing. Anyway, that's the way it was. And came the day when I found out why I had to work there. Why I was in this menial job. Because I had a lesson to learn and I couldn't realize what it was. What that job did to me was it changed my values. See, my values were always based on money, property, and prestige. And at one time, I had those things, and I always came up empty, as I described earlier. I always came up empty. But, you know, I would never be able to tell you the tremendous gratitude that I felt when my oldest son made first-string varsity and invited me to attend his first football game. My God, what a miracle. I walked into that stadium choking on gratitude. This is such a new emotion for me. Choking on gratitude for being able to be there, sober. Because I realized how different it could have been had I been drinking. I maybe wouldn't even have shown up on one of the most important days in my kid's life. And I walked into the stadium and I sat clear in the end. And I watched those kids warming up out there. And it's like Norm Alpie used to say, my God, I could have missed it all. You know, I could have missed it all. And when they announced his name over the loudspeaker as a starting player, I broke down and cried. My gratitude came out of my eyes and my ears and my heart. My second son
followed in his footsteps. And I was out there every Friday, crying. As a matter of fact, one of our members had a kid playing on the opposing team from my kid. You knew who that was, Susie. And we went to the game together. And you know, my kid was in the end. His kid was in the end zone, and my kid was guarding him. My kid intercepted a pass that was meant for him, and ran that ball back 65 yards. And I went eight, you know, God, I tell you, I went crazy. It's the first time I wet my pants as I sobered up. My boys are doing just so great. Anybody need any insurance? One of my boys is out in Thousand Oaks, and he is doing so well. He has three grandsons he's given me. And he has a beautiful spiritual wife. And they, a few years ago, they became born-again Christians, and they invited me out to the wedding and to the reception. And I went to the reception, and I was watching all these people, you know, dancing around and drinking their little champagnes. And my son came and knelt by my chair, and he put his hand on my arm, and he said, "Mother, I've got to talk to you very seriously." And I said, "What do you want, John?" And he said, "Mother, you got to be saved." I said, "Jesus, you don't know what it is to be saved." He got married in a, you know, the first time he got married in that formal way, and I had been away for a long time. I'd been in Honolulu by now, and I remember standing behind those double doors where the old lady, you know, waits for somebody to drag her down the aisle, and I was standing there with, I had a green satin dress, and God, it was beautiful. I had flowers in my hair, and I was, you know, just elegant as hell, and I was thinking how different everything was, you know. God, I'd had a bath and I had underwear on, and how come, you know, how come me? And then just about that time, the doors opened and my oldest son reached in and grabbed me, and he put my arm under his, and he gave me a big squeeze, you know, and that was a message. That was a message, you know. He was so proud of me when we walked down the aisle. And as we approached the front of the church, I saw on the right-hand side all those ladies of my neighborhood that had not talked to me for a long time. I used to drink with their husbands, see. They didn't like me. But I was a terrible threat around that neighborhood. As I was walking, they looked at me like they were looking, like they saw an apparition of something. Because they hadn't seen me since I got sober. And, you know, I sat down, and the lady who lived next door to me patted me on the shoulder. As I turned, she kissed me on the cheek. And that's another message. That was another message. And, of course, the front rows were occupied by my AA friends. And so this kid that I'm talking about now took me to Oxnard to talk up there at a convention. And he heard me talk. And when we got back into the car, there was silence for quite some time. And he said to me, "Mother, the next time you talk to those people, you tell them that if it wasn't for them, I wouldn't be where I am today. I thought you'd like to know that." My other son is doing wonderfully. He has also married a born-again Christian. See, this is a spiritual program, isn't it? And they're just fine boys. They're just fine boys. I've never had a bit of problem with either one of them. They've been very supportive of me. They love Alcoholics Anonymous. But, you know, I could go on for many more minutes telling you of the wonders that have happened to me in AA and the joy that I've had. But I have to also share with you my pain. because this program is about learning how to live without drinking. My daughter at the age of 15 picked up her first drink and another alcoholic was born. And I was to know the frustration, the heartache, the wondering, the going to juvenile halls, going to police stations, signing the APBs, sleepless night. Those of you who have kids out there, you know what I'm talking about. And came the day when she had had a crisis in her own life and decided that she wanted no more of it. And it was precisely at that time that God decided I needed to move, because he sent the banker around the corner to buy my house. And so it was that I had enough money to move us to Honolulu, where I became, I ran a woman's recovery house, St. Francis Hospital. And my daughter did well there for about 3 months, but then again it was a rerun. And we went back and forth, and I kept taking her back and throwing her out, and taking her back and throwing her out. And it was just agonizing, it was agonizing. And since we had an Al-Anon meeting in that house, that's where I decided I needed to join Al-Anon. Because I knew that I was killing this girl by keep taking her back and making it easier for her to do what she had to do. And so came the day when I had to do the last thing I wanted to do. And that was to take her down to the Honolulu airport and tell her to get the hell out of my life, because she was in too much trouble. And I had to walk away as fast as I could, because I knew that though she was crying and screaming and begging for another chance, that if I did take her back, I'd kill her. And so I walked away as fast as I could and went back to the house where, in the safety of the Al-Anon women and the AA women and the alcoholic women that were there. And so a few months later, my boss gave me a short vacation, and of course I wanted to return to Southern California, the cradle of sobriety, and to fill my own cup, because I didn't realize that running that recovery house with the women was draining me, and I needed to come and fill my own cup with some very strong AA. And I came up here, and of course I visited all my groups, my home groups, and I was to go into the Sunday night shoot meeting to hear my daughter read chapter 5 from the podium, and it tore me up. I would like to say to you that from that day to this, she has never found it necessary to drink or use any other drugs. But unfortunately, I have no such report to make. Because after a couple of years, she did get her second year K. She chose to go back out to that never, never land, where there is never any hope, where there's only blackness, where you do what you have to do to get what you have to get. And so she has been in and out all these years. And I tell you that last year, my 24th year, was the most painful of my entire life, because it became necessary for me to physically take her 18-month-old son away from her. He was in such terrible, terrible physical shape. And I had to take him home with me and keep him there for a month. He was so traumatized. He was in such bad shape. And you know, I know she couldn't help it. I know what the disease does. I know she loved that little kid. But I had to put that little boy up for adoption. I thought I was going to die. I really thought I was going to die. At the same time, my brother died and my mother died. And I thought, God, How much can I stand? What's next? I was not able to listen to you people. Don't ask me about steps. Don't ask me about any of those things. All I could remember is Clancy saying, some days you just hang on. That's all I could remember. Some days you just hang on. I know that my daughter is still out there someplace. She's out there, you know, she was dragging that kid around to the worst dope dens in Santa Ana and disappearing for days at a time. And I know that she's out there someplace with a needle in her arm right now. And I can't do anything about that. I can't. But I had to take the responsibility of that little kid that I dearly loved. And you know, I could tell you that I've had a lot of faith, but you know, I didn't have any trust. Because they keep telling me that everything's going to be all right, and I didn't believe it. I knew that it was never going to be all right again. I knew that it was never going to be all right. How could it be all right? But as I said, I didn't have any trust. And I'll have to tell you that the best analogy I've heard of the difference between faith and trust is picture two skyscrapers with a rope strung across, and on this rope hangs a basket with a baby in it. Now, I always had enough faith to know that that baby would somehow safely get across. Trust comes when you get in the basket. And I had to get in the basket. I have a message of hope for you people who are feeling that kind of pain, that kind of despair. Because the way it all turned out was something I could never have planned in a million years. This baby now is in South Carolina with a couple that were married for 9 years and unable to have children. And he is a captain in the Air Force, and they are eating him alive with love. And you know, the bonus of the whole thing is that this woman has kept in touch with me and sent me pictures, and I am now Aunt Mary to that kid. And so, to those of you who are on the edge of maybe suicide the way I was, I have to confess that I was contemplating suicide at that time because I couldn't see any out for this. But again, get in the basket. Get in the basket. With all my heart, I thank God for my sobriety. Everything I have, everything I hold dear, I got right here from the people who cared about me when I couldn't care about myself. You have honored me by letting me be your friend. But most of all, for teaching me to walk in the dignity of sobriety, I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart.